And we are here.
We are here.
We are the Baylor College of Medicine Residents Podcast. I'm one of your hosts and the chief sound engineer, Eric Anderson.
And I'm another host, Brandon Garcia, as well as the admin.
And I'm head writer. My name's Jennifer Deeger.
And we are all students here at Baylor College of Medicine. And this is the inaugural episode of the new student hosted and run podcast, with our aim being to offer an additional medium to showcase the research and clinical work of the faculty here at the college.
Yeah, and we just want to give a perspective of the students of what's going on here at Baylor. There's tons of crazy and awesome and cool things that are going on that really we think people need to know about. There's a lot of other ways that you can hear somewhat about it, but we wanted to give a student perspective because we want students to know what's out there.
Yeah, and if anyone's interested in research, it's a really good way to figure out, you know, not only the work of different faculty, but also their personalities.
Yeah, and so to give a quick background about the format of the podcast, what we're going to do here is start with a quick introduction. We call it the roundtable, where we talk about the podcast that or the faculty member and their research and give a little bit of background. And then we will go to about a 30-minute interview with a faculty or really anybody here at the college on whatever topic that we're going to be talking about. So for instance, today we're going to be talking with Dr. Shirsty Agard about the microbiome. So the three of us have worked on the episode to help write it. So we're going to give a little bit of background on it.
Yeah, so the microbiome is this collection of microbial symbiotes that live within us and on us that kind of interact in our whole lives. Instead of thinking of the human or a human as being a single entity that's going about and living on the earth, we're actually an ecosystem.
Definitely. As I was researching for this episode, I learned that, you know, we've basically known about the microbiome or microbes on our body in some sense since the 17th century with the great Antoni von Leeuwenhoek, right? I think I said that right.
Leeuwenhoek.
Hopefully.
Leeuwenhoek.
Yeah. And so he apparently was comparing his oral and fecal even microbiota in some of his early categorizations with his microscope.
Someone had to do it.
Somebody had to do it. So we've really known about microbes living on the body in some fashion for a very long time, but it wasn't really until computers and you know, everybody hears big data, until all of that came along, that really allowed us to start to expand and detect microbes in a new fashion, in a new light.
You're talking about like whole genome sequencing, like Illumina type stuff.
Yeah,
right?
16S RNA sequencing, really. I mean, that's I think what we're going to be talking to Dr. Agard about. And so, yeah, with just pipelines and metabolomics, as we are able to analyze larger data sets, this has really opened up our ability to study the microbiome from just, you know, the 19th century, put a bacteria onto a plate and then see what grows.
Yeah, but it's crazy how computers have helped with the sequencing technology so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just in the growth in the last like 50, now I guess almost 70, oh God, years.
Yeah, it's really been amazing, and it can't be understated just how beneficial this information is going to be, because, you know, you can go and read papers about the gut brain axis, and Dr. Agard's going to talk a little bit about how the metabolism of these bacteria, this ecosystem within us, can actually impact how we think, how we feel, and some of the things that we've got going on. It's really fairly interesting. And she got her start from something called the Human Microbiome Project, which was headed up here at Baylor along with several other institutions like the Broad Institute, Washington University, and the Craig Venter Institute. They wanted to, just like how we had the Human Microbiome, not the Human Microbiome, the Human Genome Project. The Human Microbiome Project plays a similar role. They started in 2008, decided to do a reference library of like 3,000 different samples. And Dr. Agard's going to talk a little bit about her involvement and the role she played here at Baylor in accomplishing that. And now we have this reference metabolomic and microbiome genome set that we can compare and start looking at how our microbiome can influence disease.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And so I guess to get to the next part of the podcast, we would like to introduce Dr. Shirsty Agard. So Dr. Agard completed her MD from the University of Minnesota and PhD from Mayo Clinic in their joint degree program. She completed her residency training at the University of Minnesota, fellowship in maternal fetal medicine at the University of Utah, and a master's in clinical investigation from the University of Utah. She is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology and subspecializes in maternal fetal medicine. Her lab's focus is on the interaction that the microbiome has on preterm birth and in utero environment and epigenetics and fetal programming and development. Her lab was the first to provide sequencing evidence for a placental microbiome. So without further ado, here is our interview with Dr. Agard. Thank you, first off, for doing this and being here. And so Dr. Agard is close to our hearts as the co-director, one of the co-directors of the MD-PhD program here at Baylor. Before we get going, if we could just hear kind of how has your research developed over your career from, you know, what you, maybe you were doing in your PhD to your fellowship to, yeah, just to now.
Right. Oh, thank you. Yeah. And thanks, you guys, for doing this. Yeah. This is going to be fun and going to be a nice new contribution to the Baylor community.
We hope so.
Me too. This is awesome. I love it. Great innovation on your guys' end. So I think maybe how all of the different work and research I've done will look more like a tapestry and less like a kind of scattered rug on the floor by the time I get to the end of my career. But I can definitely see how the strands are weaving together at this point. So very early on, my kind of first foray into biomedical research was with Dr. Dorothy Patton at the University of Washington when I was a summer undergraduate student. And she was a phenomenal investigator. She worked in non-human primates. And we studied how chlamydial infections in bulbar tissue of the eye and in fimbria from the fallopian tubes could lead to things like blindness in babies and also pelvic inflammatory disease and infertility. And that created an initial love of both reproductive science and infections and immunity. And so I, after that summer experience, I went back to my small undergraduate liberal arts college and continued, you know, my undergraduate career as a rower and as a biology major. And then the next summer went to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, where I started looking at T-cell immunity and became really interested in how our immune systems become educated and poised over time to either battle infection or tolerate ourselves. And during that time, I really came to love the immunology program at Mayo. It was an incredibly exciting time to be there and launched into eventually what became my graduate training. There was an incredible cadre of investigators at the time at Mayo, people like Jerry Gleick, who really understood how eosinophils worked, and Connie and Yergaranzi, who were doing groundbreaking work on rheumatology, my own thesis advisor, Diane Jelnick, who was an expert in B cell biology, Paul Liebman, who discovered how natural killer cells and how you can silence parts of the immune system. These were just really, really exciting times. And so eventually went on, did my PhD in immunology and was really interested in the development of your humoral immune system and B cell biology.
Okay. So you started off in immunology for your PhD, I guess because of your interest in infectious disease, that's kind of the direction you went.
Right.
So how'd you get to the microbiome? I have this question too of like, is it typical for immunology, or people who are doing most of the research in the microbiome, did they start out as immunologists and make the jump, or where does that field come from?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So a lot of the folks who eventually get around to doing work in the microbiome either come out of microbiology, they're microbiologists that have a long-standing interest in bacteria and viruses, which has always been a clinical interest of mine. A lot of them are immunologists because they're fundamentally interested in how do you know the difference between a commensal or a healthy microbe and a potentially pathogenic or pathobiont, so something can cause harm. And computational biologists. Hmm. So it's a really heavy computational field. And so a lot of people who do microbiome research are computational biologists. Hmm. So those are kind of the three big picture team of folks who foray into that field.
What do you mean by computational?
Oh, good question. So computational biologists, some people call them data scientists or big data researchers. They're people who are used to not just doing bioinformatics or moving data from point A to point B, but also people who have some usually pretty strong biostatistical and mathematical background so that they can analyze and account for variance and things like that in large data sets. Great question.
Well, so I'm kind of curious, when did people start, because you know you were talking about kind of good bacteria versus bad bacteria, and then that's sort of now really in the mainstream, right. But like when did this thinking really start to, like when did you notice people start actually talking about like, oh, this thing is the microbiome?
Right.
I guess I'm not looking so much for the coinage, but like when you, it sort of came on your radar.
Yeah, so there's kind of two answers to that. So I think for a lot of us, it was always on our radar.
Really?
Because we've recognized since we could first look through a microscope,
right,
that microbes lived in communities, mm-hmm, and that we had bajillions of inhabitants on our body that were microbial. Okay. So we've known that for a long time, and it really is a fundamental question over,
right,
how is it that we don't try to get rid of some microbes, but we do try to get rid of others?
Right.
And that has a lot of parlance into cancer as well, right?
Yeah.
Why does our immune system not do anything when it's not a cancer cell, and then when it goes a little bit out of whack, now we know how to do something. Mm-hmm. So I think those are really, you know, part and parcel of each other. And so it's been on people's horizon for a long time.
Hmm.
I would say I'd answer the question about how did I become interested in it in kind of three ways. So we talked about each of kind of the three different big picture folks who,
right,
certainly account for a reasonable populace within the microbiome science field. So I definitely had the immunology background. I definitely have a longstanding interest in subspecialty with infectious diseases and pregnancy. And I did have a opportunity to learn something about big data science through the Utah Population Database. So when I was a fellow at the University of Utah, we worked with very, very large data sets. Mm. And how did we really integrate those data sets, and had a pretty strong background in the biostatistics of big data. Mm. So when we were first kind of looking at the Human Microbiome Project here at Baylor, I got brought on board, frankly, because they needed somebody who could A, do vaginal sampling,
okay,
and B, had been involved in a lot of clinical trials and big data science work, but more on the clinical trials arm than on the genomic sciences arm. And so I kind of fit that bill, and
right,
was for my first couple weeks at Baylor, I got pulled into the project and,
oh, wow,
never looked back.
It was,
yeah,
that soon.
Yeah, it was really early on when I came here.
You mind telling us a little bit about what the Human Microbiome Project is?
Yeah. So the Human Microbiome Project was a very large, what we call roadmap initiative with the National Institutes of Health. So other examples of that are the Human Genome Project, the Epigenomics Project, all of which have had its roots here at Baylor College of Medicine because of our Genome Center,
right,
and really the eminent work of Richard Gibbs in bringing in these types of science and investigations. And we have so much to thank him for along those lines. So the Human Microbiome Project, they really needed our computational and genomic science folks here at Baylor to run, but those folks aren't necessarily quite as fluent in how do you convince a woman to come, yeah, in and loan us her vaginal samples every couple of months,
right,
for a long period of time. And,
right,
how do you actually design a study where you could create a quote-unquote healthy reference population? So the goals of the Human Microbiome Project were to enroll 300 people across two sites, 150 at Washington University and 150 at Baylor College of Medicine. They were to be longitudinally collected, meaning we'll see the same person multiple times and collect samples. And they were ultimately to to function as a reference population. Mm. So not necessarily normal, right?
Right.
We wanted them to be reference, meaning they reflected what the population of the U.S. looks like. And so we had kind of some healthy individuals, and we used some clearly defined criteria that we set up a priori or in advance of the study. But then we also went ahead and had some branch points off where people could do demonstration projects. So they could do things like study pediatric populations. We studied some pregnant populations. Those types of things could go on simultaneously.
Great. You mentioned something about convincing people to come in for vaginal swabbing every couple of months. And I have a couple of questions. First of all, can you comment a little bit on what you mean by building that trust, and how were you able to convince people to participate in the study long term?
Great question.
And then after that, I kind of want to know, because we know a little bit about how you got into looking at the placental microbiome. Mm-hmm. Could you then tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, of course. So with the Human Microbiome Project per se, there was a pretty good cash incentive to participate in this study.
That always helps.
Because we were looking for a reference population, including young, healthy people, you know, we certainly had a reasonable number of folks who were students. Mm. Whether they were students here at Baylor or students at the University of Texas, Houston, they were from a number of different situations, but they weren't all students. They really represented cross-sectional community. We screened over twice as many people as we actually enrolled.
Oh, wow.
Because one really interesting component of this was we did a lot of oral sampling. Hmm. So we had skin microbiome. We had the gut or stool microbiome. We had the vaginal microbiome in women. And then we had the oral microbiome. And those involved quite a few sites in the mouth. So we had to rely upon our dental colleagues and really great collaborations with our dental colleagues. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of folks who ended up being excluded because of not being able to meet some of the dental health mm-hmm. criteria. And so that was a lot of the sampling. It usually would take them a couple of hours every time they came in for sampling.
Oh, wow. Well, mm-hmm. and then, yeah, we're kind of curious, how did this feed in then? Did this kind of initiate your research into the placental microbiome, or was it maybe, I don't know, were you thinking of you were going to go that direction before mm-hmm. you came on? Because it seems like, at least from reading that paper, that served as your reference population. Is that correct?
So that's a great question. So yes, we did use the Human Microbiome Project reference cohort as it was designed and intended this is what, if you had a non-pregnant population, what they look like. So I'm going to answer that question in two ways. So one is, a lot of the work that we had done ultimately involved something called the developmental origins of disease. So we're very interested in how pregnancy exposures can change the future risk of health, especially metabolic health in the children. And we look at a variety of different situations of that. And so we've done a lot on understanding the epigenomic or upon the genome changes. We understand something about the genomic changes. But this developmental origins of health and disease was a major focus of my research prior to the start of the Human Microbiome Project. What became obvious as these kind of two parallel worlds were chugging along, the more work I was doing on the Human Microbiome Project, the more I became curious, could our understandings of the microbiome explain a lot of this development origins of disease? In other words, could there be exposures during pregnancy that changed your microbiome and subsequently changed your metabolic health?
Right.
And so they were really parallel research interests that I started to see where they potentially connected. So we did a study that we published in the HMP collection on looking at the vaginal microbiome during pregnancy, and we compared it to non-pregnant individuals that arose from the Human Microbiome Project. And one of the things we learned was that the vaginal microbiome during pregnancy was a little bit less rich, a little bit less diverse than non-pregnant, but it's not like you suddenly had entirely different species and genre there.
Right.
it was kind of some subtle differences. About that time, a couple of papers started emerging that were characterized from other investigators around the world that started characterizing the microbiome in infants in their first week of life. And what we noticed was very little of those infant microbiomes were present in the vagina, including if you looked in pregnancy. So we kind of had this question of, well, if they're there when the baby's born, A, how long have they been there? And right. B, where'd they come from? Because they don't look like the vagina. That's like right. 80% lactobacillus. And so we started to hypothesize that maybe our premise that babies are born sterile isn't actually true. Now, there was quite a bit of evidence if you went into mice and into some other setting that that may be the case. But we initially ran those placental samples that we first did as controls. We weren't expecting to really find anything there.
So quick question. Yeah. When you say that like the prevailing thought was yeah. that babies are born sterile, mm-hmm. do you mean like they were born and they had no microbiome on them at all? Or mm-hmm. were they before the birthing process sterile while they're in utero and then they were kind of
both.
I guess
yeah, okay. those two go together. Exactly. Good question. So the intrauterine environment, the premise was the intrauterine environment was relatively quote unquote sterile. And mm-hmm. so babies are born without an actual microbiome present yet. That was okay. kind of the prevailing thought.
Okay. And if that was the accepted thought, did you get a lot of pushback when you said, hey, babies aren't sterile?
Well, so we never said, with that paper, we never said, hey, babies aren't sterile. We were pretty conservative in what we said. And what we said was, we can detect a low biomass, low abundance, metagenomic community in the 320 placentas we looked at. So we've always been very cautious that we don't know if it's an actual viable microbiome community, meaning are there live colonizing microbes? We remain agnostic to that at this point. We don't really know the answer to that. Certainly some individuals, some other research groups, including quite a few really, really talented research programs in Finland and Iceland and Norway have done some very nice work where they've been able to cultivate out microbes from the placenta. We have not been able to, but we have only tried to use clinical cultivation pipelines to do so. But to this day, what we've really limited ourselves to doing is describing that metagenomic community in the placenta. We also went on and published a paper with one of our incredibly talented MSTP students, Derek Chu, really led this initiative. And we looked at the microbiome in neonates within an hour of birth, and then those same neonates at 4 to 6 weeks of age. And we are able to further our findings in the placenta and show, first of all, we can detect, again, metagenomically, microbes in babies right at birth. And second of all, we found that we really see quite a bit of diversification and body niche speciation, meaning they look more adult-like. So their oral microbiome's different than their skin's, different than their stool by as early as 4 to 6 weeks of age. So we've been able to expand out these findings, certainly in humans. Mm.
So it sounds like when children are born, they have this bit of a microbiome, and then mm-hmm. over time it differentiates and becomes separate from one another.
Exactly, a little bit more mature. So you'll see this body site speciation. Mm-hmm. Now, we've also been doing some parallel studies in non-human primates using a model that we developed for epigenomic research to try to understand. Initially, we thought we'd be understanding how maternal obesity leads to obesity in subsequent generations. What mm-hmm. we found instead in our non-human primate work is that maternal high-fat diet or caloric-dense diet is what actually lends to that. It's not the maternal obesity per se, which was kind of a big, exciting change in the literature. Mm-hmm. But we've done these parallel studies in non-human primates, and we've published several papers now where we've been able to show that a maternal high-fat diet changes that offspring's microbiome detectable at birth, and still prevalent with a strong footprint of that maternal diet at 3 years of age, wow, even when you switch that offspring onto a controlled diet at the time of weaning. So you can still see the impact of a maternal high-fat diet on an offspring's microbiome in monkeys at 3 years of age, even if they've been fed a controlled diet for 2.5 years. So that also now starts being indirect evidence that what they're exposed to during gestation and lactation, we can't separate the two in our primate model, has a persistent and lasting influence on the offspring's microbiome, consistent with the notion that something is going on in that intrauterine environment, whether it's truly colonizing the fetus or it's just creating a milieu that enables live microbes to seed the fetus immediately at or after birth. Again, we don't have the data around at this moment in time.
Well, and you bring up a good point of this is all based off of sequencing data. And a lot of people have trouble culturing some of this stuff. And so I guess that brings into another question. It's clear that a lot of microbiome research is kind of on the shoulders of, you know, the development in sequencing technology and computational pipelines and everything like that. What do you think, like right now, what do you think some of the main downsides or issues with the technology that are maybe holding further developments?
Great question. Yeah. So I'd say, I think there's really kind of three things that I always try to keep in mind. First, I always try to remember that we developed metagenomics or sequencing technology to compensate for the fact that we can only cultivate or culture 10 to 15% of microbes at best. Because you have great variation between aerobic and anaerobic, knowing what their requirements are for growth, and that they exist in complex communities. So kind of the analogy I think about is we know that if we take a lion off the savanna grasslands of Africa and plunk it into our Houston Zoo, right, it's not going to reproduce as well. And in fact, we're going to fundamentally change that lion and the properties once we take it out of its niche, right?
Right.
Doesn't not make it a lion, but we're going to have fundamental changes. Its behavior will be different. So microbes aren't that different. You take them out of their niche, it's very hard to recapitulate that niche in ways that we can really study. There's a lot of work being done. That's a lot of what the organoid and enteroid work is all about. But that, you know, as it exists. So I would say that's kind of statement number one, which brings up problem number one. How do we recapitulate those niches in ways that we can study these microbes and their function better? The second thing is when we're doing the metagenomic sequencing, the resolution, the degree to which we have to sequence a sample to get the strain resolution, right? And strains matter.
Yeah.
So there's, you know,
genus and then
exactly. Yeah. King Philip, whatever that acronym was once upon a time, right? King Philip always something rather. Yeah.
And when you say strain, you mean even past the species.
Past the species. Yeah, like salmonella into very specific has a bunch. Strain. Right. Yeah. Right. So one strain of Streptococcus pneumoniae is different than another strain of Streptococcus pneumoniae, right? And we're down to strain levels when we think about pathogen and commensal at times.
Right.
So those are really, really important differences because they make different metabolites, which we then utilize or don't utilize. And they utilize our metabolites or don't use. You have to get down to some pretty deep sequencing to do that, which is then leads to the next kind of challenge we're all struggling with. You know, we will go on and we'll sequence at 5, 10, 20 GB per sample. Well, before you know it, you're having to deal with 30, 40, 50 TB data sets. That's just like a lot of money and space.
Yeah, you just said TB and GB.
Oh, sorry.
I think it's really interesting talking to you about the microbiome and stuff like that because I get the microbiology and the immunology, but the second you start saying anything computer-wise, I kind of get that glassy-eyed look. Yeah. So
gigabytes and bases.
Yeah. Okay.
Terabases, gigabytes, yeah. Yeah, so we measure our sequencing not necessarily in bases, but in space, and then the data can get measured in either bases or space. So we talk about both of those interchangeably.
It's crazy how I mean, because I've done a little bit of sequencing work, but not a lot. But even just in that experience, it's like you have to have it housed. You have to have a server to house the information on. And so it takes a lot of resources. So, I mean, that's probably another limitation of this right now.
And so that's something, you know, Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital have been very thoughtful around. Yeah. So we have kind of two microbiome centers. Joe Petrosino runs the Center for Microbiome Metagenomics Research here at Baylor. He's done a really, really nice job about making sure he's continued to develop those metagenomic pipelines and the capacity to do super high-end sequencing and try to get us to strain resolution. And then the Texas Children's Microbiome Center is run by Jim Versalovic. And that one has taken a little bit different approach and done a lot of work on the metabolomics. And so has been very, very interested in how do you do the functional readouts of these metabolites, especially in pediatric population. Sure.
One thing I think would be interesting to talk about, just outside of science and stuff like that, you've got a lot of groups that are kind of look at like microbiome and stuff like that and kind of think of it as like, you know, being able to explain a lot of the weird things we kind of see in society, like with reactions to things like medicines and vaccines and all this other stuff. What kind of implication do you think the microbiome has on other fields in medicine aside from just infectious disease?
So that's a great question. So I think one of the things I constantly try to remind myself is antibiotics aren't the only antimicrobials we deal with. So metformin or glucophage is a great example of an antimicrobial agent. We use it for diabetes management, but it's known to have antimicrobial properties.
Really?
It's not the only one. Proton pump inhibitors have antimicrobial properties. So typically we think of antibiotics as being the only antimicrobes, but there's actually quite a few others we can think about. You know, there was a big story that I think we've kind of calmed down a little bit and provided a different perspective. Maybe C-sections, delivering a baby by cesarean is antimicrobial. We don't find that to be true in any of our data and research, and larger longitudinal studies support what we've observed as well. But those are examples of things that we have to think beyond just antibiotics as being antimicrobial. So I think that's a really good example of where kind of this field can be paradigm shifting, is thinking about how important good microbes are for us and understanding antibiotics aren't our only antimicrobials.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so I guess, again, thank you for kind of coming here and talking to us about all this. And just to wrap it up, just a broad question of if you have any advice for really just MDs or PhDs or PAs in terms of deciding kind of like what field you want to go into and kind of devote your career to, because I think a lot of us have anxiety at this early age in our career where like there's so many options, it's almost a paradox of choice, and it's like we don't really know what to do. And I don't know if you have any advice for how to navigate those waters.
Just do what you love to do.
Yeah.
And if you go into a field because you love it and you can be passionate about it, you can advocate for your patients for the rest of your life, you can feel like, okay, maybe there's me and one other person on the planet that care about the answer to this question, but at least that's two of us, right? You know, so whatever you do, just, you know, do it with passion, do it with good intent. And all of this, you know, rigmarole about burnout and blah, yada, yada, I don't know. First of all, you got to be on fire before you burn out. And second of all, you know, it seems like those flames just keep cropping up if you're doing something you're passionately interested in. I didn't ever go into this business thinking I'd become a high-risk obstetrician. You know, I thought I'd become an infectious disease doctor or a hematology oncologist or something along those lines. And, you know, I just love taking care of women and their babies. Yeah. I mean, I have like the best job in the whole universe. And then I get to find out some secrets about how can they help their children be healthier, smarter, better than they were.
Right.
You know, because I don't know, sometimes I'm worried about the shape we're leaving our world in for you guys. You guys have a lot of our messes to still clean up and a lot of questions we haven't been able to solve. But I think if we can arm you guys well, you're going to be able to come up with those solutions we failed to come up with in our careers.
Well, yeah. Thank you again.
My pleasure. So thanks, you guys, for doing this. It's awesome.
All right. And that is it for now. Brennan and I would like to thank everybody out there who took the time to listen to this episode. Special thanks to Jennifer Deeger for helping write and edit some of the questions. Thank you to Dr. Poitras for serving as our faculty advisor and helping us put this whole thing together. Thank you to the Baylor College of Medicine Communications Department for help with the production of this. And thank you again to Dr. Agard for taking the time to interview with us. So I guess I hope everybody enjoyed it, and we hope you tune in again soon. Bye for now.